Hi, I'm Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Modosky.
And this is Start Writing. Go
we
ahead.
We are continuing Jay's Beginner Guide to Writing, which began with a friend of his who's starting off on his first novel, giving it to Jay to read, and Jay being like, there's some things you need to know, and these are them.
Yeah, exactly. And this is our fourth episode. Last time, by way of review, we talked about character or hero, and how do you write deep characters that resonate and that seem real. And the two biggest takeaways that I hope people got out of that is that you need to cultivate your own emotional intelligence. And the more you understand emotions and how human beings think and work and feel, then you're going to be able to write those and represent them. And then the other thing I hope you took away is great artists steal. And that means you observe things in real life and in other fiction, and you build on that, and you make it yours, and you make it new. And that's one of the best ways to launch into what is a really challenging thing to do, to mimic life. There's just one thing I needed to follow up from the last episode. I said something about someone who needs protected. And I actually think I'm pretty good with grammar and language. And over the years, I've gotten critiqued on that phrasing many times. And
yeah, it sounds weird to me.
Yeah. Okay. This is going to be a fun story. This is all just a tangent, but I thought I'd bring it up because it's kind of interesting. So I literally thought every time my beta readers called me out on that, that they were just saying, there are these two choices that are both acceptable, and you might consider this other one. And it wasn't until just this last year that I realized that's an abnormal dialect. And from where I grew up, it's acceptable. And there are many places in English where it's not acceptable.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it's a colloquialism from wherever you grew up.
Well, so I have this little map on the screen that shows the United States, and the darkest shaded areas are where this phrasing is acceptable. And then you kind of see a gradient to the light areas where it is most unacceptable. And if you look closely over Montana and then sweeping down to Idaho, there's kind of a tornado shape. And the point of that tornado is where I grew up, with that little bottom peg where it's dark. This is interesting. I did some research on it. In Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, this is the way they talk. And I found this cool article in the Boston Globe. This guy moves to Pittsburgh, and the teacher sends a thing that says, your child's homework needs corrected. And he was like, what needs corrected? What is this? But it was that same structure, and it's fine in Pittsburgh, and it's not fine in Philadelphia. It's not. Or Boston. And anyway, I realized that, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is why people keep correcting me on this, because in their dialect, it's absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I learned it comes from Scotland. It's Scots English, might be the historical source, and you can read all about it in the show notes. I'll put a link if anybody's curious, but I had to defend my honor, basically.
Well, and I think there's a really interesting point here, and that is, if you get multiple corrections on something you feel is very correct, you might want to look into it the way Jay has, because we all grow up experiencing, you know, degrees of colloquialisms that we may not even realize are unique to the region we grew up in. And, you know, to, you know, the rest of the world, it may sound very broken in the way you're writing your sentences. And that's why you keep getting corrected.
Well, and so as a personal choice, like I'm Scottish. And so when I heard that, I was like, oh, it's part of my heritage. However, I don't want to sound like I'm ignorant to all the people from all the places where it's not acceptable. So I'm actually trying to stop using that, even though I think I can make a good argument that it's acceptable. It's just like, I should probably cut that out because I want to seem credible as I speak and as I write. Anyway, that's just like an interesting tidbit that we came across, and I accidentally said it in the last episode, and now here we are.
Now here we are.
That's funny. Okay, so today's lecture, I want to talk about how you build a character and how do you make them deep and real and unique? And I'm just going to dive into a bunch of tips all centered around that topic. So that's our objective today. And the first tip is a very simple one, but it's you want to have your cast be as small as possible. So, I mean, I think of Shakespeare. That's the image I have here on the screen. Like, you don't want an acting troupe of 50 people if your story only has 9 people that really need their story told. Right. And as a personal example, in my novel X Dot, remember last time I talked about, I had this character who died in the first draft and nobody cared. Yeah. One of the things that I changed to make that character matter more was I took another character and merged them together. So
both
characters were in the first draft, but one did this and the other did that. And now it's the same person doing both. And it just adds more weight. Think of your friends or whatever. You're better friends with the people that you spend more time with. That's not a hard and fast rule, but it enables you to become better friends if you spend more time with a person. And that's the same in your book. Like, this character got more screen time because the two characters became one.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, so that's tip number one right there. Make your cast as small as possible, and that will give each person in the cast more screen time.
Huh. Yeah, that's a good tip, you know, to condense your characters down.
I can't remember if I did that in Song of Locke, but I did do it again in Starchild. There was a point that suddenly these two characters could be the same person.
So did we cover this before? Because I know we talked about Seinfeld and Kramer.
No. Well, we didn't cover this specifically, but we've kind of skirted around it, I think.
Okay.
Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is making your characters distinct. And on screen in Hollywood, it's really easy to do that because they're played by two different people, right? It's not easy in a novel. And let's say you have two secret agents, that your reader is imagining them with suits and ties, they're the exact same character unless you do something to help distinguish the two. And one might be physical characteristics. So I have this image from the Man from U.N.C.L.E. up here. One doesn't wear a white shirt and tie and the other does. One's tall, one's short. You can distinguish them physically, but also through personality. And another image I have up here is Avatar: The Last Airbender. And I think they do a stellar job of making their characters seem very unique. We have Aang, the Avatar, who's so lighthearted and fun-loving. And then we have Sokka. He loves fun, right? But it's a different tone of loving fun. And he's always trying to make jokes. And he's also very serious about solving problems. He's coming up with these crazy ideas to try to fix things. He's always wanting to fix things. And then we throw in Toph. Toph's like this short and blind and stubborn and grumpy. And every single character is like this in the show. And they're all very distinct. And that's a very important thing to do as you're building your characters.
You did mention like making them distinct, like and even showing these differences here. One of the things I always think about when I'm writing a scene is if I'm dealing with non-central characters, a character that's just there for the scene. They're at a restaurant, maybe there's a hostess, maybe there's a waiter. And so whatever I do is I flip the gender of whoever that these non-essential characters are from whoever is the character taking up the most scene, just because that lets me use the short pronouns he, she.
Oh, I like that.
And avoiding a lot of name repetition because the genders are swapped and it doesn't matter, right? The gender of this character who's just here as a filler in the scene, it's not relevant. There's not a romantic interest ending there or anything. And so it just really helps me, you know, split them out from whatever character I'm dealing with very easily without creating confusion in the readers. And so it's like, if the main character in that scene is a male, then the waiter's a female, you know, and vice versa. Awesome. Just quick, easy solution to avoid confusion there.
That leads into the next slide, but let me say a couple things first. So I have these three Legos up here. One is Merlin, and he's the classic wizard, right? He's from, I don't know, 1000 AD or something. Very old legend. Actually, probably, I'm sure it's earlier than that. And then Tolkien comes along and writes Gandalf, right? And Merlin was a mortal, although not an ordinary mortal, but he was a mortal. And Tolkien sets Gandalf apart by making him essentially a demigod or something that is above mortal. And he's just, his power is simply awesome because of the way Tolkien distinguished him from this former prototypical wizard, right? And then, so I think J.K. Rowling then had a very tough job to follow that up, right? And to me, what she did with Dumbledore, I mean, it's the same pointy hat, it's the same beard, right? It's basically the same character, but Dumbledore is a man who will be essentially despised and hated by his enemies. Like, they'll cast dispersion at him and it doesn't faze him. And like, as powerful a wizard as he is, it's his heart that is the true magic, like the kindness that he expresses toward the evildoers or the people that have been shamed in the past. Like, that's how she innovated on Gandalf. And I think it's just beautiful. Like, it is a new and distinct character, despite the fact that it's another pointy hat and another beard. So these are just examples of, this is how you can distinguish characters, and it's really important to make them unique. Then last, I wanted to bring up Merry and Pippin, right? These are the hobbits. These are two of the hobbits in the Fellowship from the Lord of the Rings. And I just want to say that if you don't know the difference in personalities between Pippin and Merry, that's not your fault as a reader. That means Tolkien didn't make them that distinct, right?
Yeah. Merry and Pippin are groups because I can't separate them in my head. I'm
like, yeah. Well, and it's like, it's a little easier because the movie, they're visually different, but in the book, they're not, right? They're both just hobbits. They're exactly the same looking. And that leads me to the next point here. So I worked in user experience design, and there's a mantra in that field that says it's never the user's fault. And I think we should take that to heart as authors as well. If someone is confused, that's not the reader's fault, that's ours. And that then becomes an opportunity for us to fix that and make it so that it's not a problem in the future. And I've got this image on the screen here of a microwave, and the buttons on the side are designed very aesthetically, I would say. They're minimal, they're simple, good alignment. However, 99% of the time when someone uses a microwave, they only want one thing out of it, and that's go, turn on, right? But to find the go button on this panel right here, as sleek as it looks, it probably would take you 20 seconds because you got to read every single button until you find it.
Yeah.
Good experience design is going to make that button big and green or some other, like, it's going to stand out so that in half a second, you know, goes right there.
Goes right there. Yep.
So this is the concept that I want to talk about. How do we lead our readers along and make it just dead simple so that they don't trip or stumble as they're going through our story? And I think we need to do this by making our characters distinct, so they're not confused on who said this or that or who was doing what, you know, that they're very clear. So I recently finished again the series, the Prydain Chronicles by Lloyd Alexander, and he has very distinct characters, and he uses a very, very simple tactic to do this. There's a character named Call, and he's essentially the hero of the previous generation. So he was a warrior, he saved the day back in the day, and then he became a blacksmith, so he was forging weapons of war. That's all backstory, right? And then every time, and I should say, Call is a side character. He's not central, but he's still memorable as a side character. And part of the reason is because Alexander does two things every time Call comes up. He says, and I'll read this first quote, "Call's heart was distant, busily and happily occupied with his turnip patch." So we learned that this man is a gardener, and although he used to be a guy who would kill things with metal, Now he's a guy who cultivates things with the earth. And that's significant. But it's not just mentioned once. It keeps coming up each time we have a touch point with his character, so that that becomes very deeply ingrained. And honestly, I would say this is for a young audience. And I think for a young audience, it's okay to lay it on a little more thick. But Alexander, I think, borders on maybe too much. But that's a rare thing. And I think most beginning writers shouldn't be worried about reminding your readers too well. I mean, essentially, that's making the button on the microwave too big. And hardly anybody makes that mistake.
Yeah. Well, and we did talk about in our Action Beat episode this concept of having the recognizable trait attaching to these characters. Now, you know, this guy always thinking about his patch is a little different because it's not an action beat, that's going to come up in the middle of dialogue. But it feels in the same vein, right? He's created this identifiable trait and attached it to this character.
Yeah. And so that's like a personality trait that is pointed out. He also has the stout farmer had lost his helmet. His bald crown was scratched as if he had plunged headlong into briars. So these two things are commonly mentioned with this character, that he's a gardener and that he's bald. And that makes him visually stand out and memorable. And I noticed, so I recently did an MBA, and so I met a ton of new people, all my classmates. And I noticed that when you meet them, it's like, oh, that guy, he's the class clown. That guy, he's the Star Wars fan. And that guy, he's the weightlifter. And these are like these really simple tags that stand out. And they're not everything there is to know about that person. But they're a significant and a memorable thing. And that's what we want to do with our characters. And that doesn't stop us from going deeper later. But to just kind of have these simple tags that it's easy to remember. Oh, this guy, he's the Star Wars fan. I think that goes a long way to help to make it easy for your readers.
Yeah. So recently I've been kind of diving into more anime, and one of the things they do well, and they do a lot, is just backstory, backstory, backstory. Like if you've ever watched like a series of anime, like for every episode of actual main plot, there are like two episodes of backstories for the central characters in that main plot.
Wow.
And so what it does is it builds a deep understanding and connection to the characters. I just noticed that they do that a lot, and that these backstories are really where you can carve the uniqueness of your character, right? Mm. You want to pick an incident in their life that is interesting, right? Essentially, what you're looking for is a standalone short story of this character that tells us something about them that is relative to the plot happening now. And, you know, if you pick these moments well, they're standalone and they're great and they really strengthen these characters.
So, and you're saying like one of these flashbacks would be a whole episode?
Yeah. Yeah. So like maybe you've got these two guys who are fighting each other and they enter the ring and they're about to start. And then we get episode one, which is the backstory character. Yeah. Episode two is the backstory of the other character. And then episode three is their actual fight.
Mm. Do you have a series you recommend?
Not specifically. They do it a lot. There's a lot of different series. I think the biggest series, as far as just popularity goes, where you see this a lot is Naruto. They do it all the time. I mean, Naruto is backstory.
I haven't listened to watched a lot of anime, but I'm trying to think. I think I watched one called The Last Exile that was really good. And I feel like there was one other, but anyway. Okay, yeah. So essentially what I'm saying is that you can build these simple touch points. And then for the characters that you want to go deeper into and do this backstory thing, for example, then it leaves room to do that. And your reader is now attached to them from this simple tag or whatever, which honestly is sometimes kind of a stereotype. And I think that's fine to establish the character. I recently read Dune, getting ready for the movie, and I know, and this is about world, but honestly, just imagine the world as a character, or remember that the braid means these are all three woven together. But so Frank Herbert, three times in, I think, roughly the first chapter, he has the same phrase: Arrakis, Dune, desert planet. He repeats that three times, and this gives you the name of the planet. It helps solidify it, so you remember, okay, it's called Arrakis, it's nicknamed Dune, and it's a desert, right? And so this is like the simple stereotype of the planet. And then the whole rest of the novel, you go to Dune and you see the details of the planet, right? But he early on attaches you to it to just say, look, you know its nickname, you know what it's like there, even though you don't know the details. And I think essentially the tip that I hope you take away from this is that it's okay to be repetitive. You might go too far, but don't worry about that for now. Just start repeating things enough that your readers get it, and it's very solid and very clear. Okay, let's see how we're doing on time. So I love this. There's an author and blogger named Larry Brooks, and I have his storyfix.com up here. I learned some really cool things about plot from him, and we're going to dive into that's the next lecture if we get through all this today. But I wanted to go through this simple description. He has these 9 questions, and there are a few more that I'll share with you in the show notes. But it's basically a character sketch. It's a way for you to start fleshing out what your character thinks and feels and what matters to them. And I wanted to take you through this in relation to one of my characters, because when I did, I came across, I had a, I guess you could say, a profound realization. It changed the character. And so I just kind of want to take you through that story. And this is part of your homework. I don't know if you're doing the homework, but I'll send this to you and you can do this on your characters. And I mean, let's say you have 8 or 9 characters in your novel. I would guess one of them at least is going to, you'll suddenly realize, oh my gosh, there was this thing about them that I just hadn't considered till now. Okay. So the first item, write a 10-word description of the character. So I wrote Knack. So this is from my novel, Starchild. Knack is a rogue pilot who stole one of the galaxy's rarest spaceships. Okay.
So I feel like half of that's the description and part of that is just his backstory, right?
Okay. Well, so you're saying that you want a physical description.
Well, I guess, yeah. Based on the directive, it felt like you abandoned the course halfway through. Like,
well, no, that's fair. And it's so funny because you can go deep on character, and the document I'll share with you has this short version, but then there's a long version and it's massive. There's like 100 questions that you ask about your character. And yeah, I think physical description is actually really cool. I think that's why the Avatar characters work so well. I mean, like, you got a short one, you got a tall one, you got one with a scar. And I think making them stand out physically is actually a really important point, Joe. And I don't really cover that here, but yeah, I think you're right on the money. Okay, so the next question, what does your character want? And I wrote, Knack wants more money, another privateer gig, and the safety of seclusion. So he's got this stolen valuable ship, and he kind of hunkers down in it, right? That's how he makes his money, but he has to defend it because it's everybody wants to steal it, essentially. What does the character need? He needs to protect his ship, right? Right. What does he fear? He's afraid that someone will steal it. And he's afraid of trusting other people because that might mean they could steal it. And then, so hit Larry Brooks, his fifth question. Now reconsider question 3. What does this character really need? And it was somewhere along here that I came to my realization. I was like, oh, he doesn't, it's not about the ship. It's not about solitude. He's isolated. He's isolated himself and he's lonely and disconnected. And that's the real battle, right? It's an emotional battle. How does he learn to trust or how does he dare to trust if it means risking this, you know, extremely valuable ship? anyway, so I kept going, who stands in the way? What does this obstacle look like? So previously the obstacles were other people trying to steal the ship. And then suddenly I'm realizing, oh my gosh, it's himself. Like he's who stands in the way of him making connections. And that's a big difference, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is one example of kind of an aha that I had as I was fleshing out a character. And there's a lot of opportunities to have these as you write and answer these sometimes strange questions. I'll show you more of them here in a sec.
Reading through these now, I'm starting to like ponder them with my characters, and I've gotten my own revelations just now.
Now, I don't know if you want to share off the cuff. You don't have to, but...
So there's this question. What does the character fear most? And I was thinking of my character from the series. And I think part of the answer manifests to me from just what I've written. And so if we look at the series of books, he starts off as a PhD student who's, you know, made some brilliant discoveries, you know, and you know, he wants to go into research to be able to produce knowledge for the world and kind of shape humanity's future that way. Like that's what he wants his contribution to be through the scientific research and understanding. And then he gets dragged into this world of secrets and espionage. And at the very beginning of this, one of the things he fears about becoming involved with the CIA and everything is that all his great ideas and discoveries will be buried in some secret vault rather than shared with the world. And so I think like that is his fear, right? That all his scientific research will never impact humanity because of how he's become involved in this. And, you know, I guess, you know, in the subliminal that was there, but I never intentionally put it there.
Yeah.
And I think it's something I should address at some point in the series is this fear of his that, you know, because he got dragged into this world of subterfuge and, you know, there's this fear of the weaponization of his research, then it may never come to light for the rest of the world.
Now, you don't have to answer this because it'd probably be a spoiler, but what would it look like if he bolstered himself against this fear, like if he attacked it or... Yeah, you don't have to answer if it's...
So I think it's something he has to wrestle with is... the fear is that, you know, one is his root fear is that it will never see the real light of day. But at the same time, if it does that, people will attempt to turn it into a weapon because they've been trying to do that for the last 20 years of his life, you know? So I think it's two fears that he's just kind of torn between. And in the current draft of the final book, I never addressed that, but I think I should.
Yeah. Dude, that's cool. Yeah, so I'm going to share this really long document with these things, and I've often had these ahas that I just hadn't considered, and it's nice to have a tool that kind of leads your mind along. And it won't work for every character, but I find that it often works. Okay, so we can either do a super long episode. I think I'm going to just cut with this slide, and then so we'll do kind of two short episodes.
Okay.
Well, slightly shorter. It's still 35 minutes, but... okay, so I wanted to talk through the braid. Maybe you're sick of this, but this is how I think, and it happened to be because I was writing a magic system in Star Child, and everything in my mind just aligned itself to this system. but I wanted to talk about three main areas that you need to consider when you're building a character. And so the first one is vision. That means like what's in their mind, right? Their thoughts. And so this means their knowledge. What do they know? What have they learned? What do they believe? And why do they believe that? What is their history and their past? What are the things they want? What are they afraid of? What are they good at? And what are they bad at? For me and Joe are characters here because we're not good with the numbers. but having something that a character is not good at matters. And having them be really competent at other things matters. And with vision, you're setting up the past for this character, their mindsets and stuff. But that makes it so that your character can then go from that place that's been clearly established and move to another place. So they believe this, now they believe that. They knew this, now they also know that. And this this journey is important, and you can only have a journey if you've made it clear where they're coming from. The second one is initiative. And so if the first one is mind, the second one is body, right? And that means they need to be proactive. They need to do things. They need to be striving. And it doesn't mean that they're, you know, the perfect Stephen Covey, every habit of their life is perfect. It means with one thing, one important thing that's related to their story, they need to be striving. And I feel like this is a mistake that newbies make a lot. They have a character and the plot just happens to them. And they're like, oh my gosh, what am I doing here? And now this, and they're swept away and captured and whatever. That's not good. They need to have something that they're striving really tirelessly to solve. And that's going to make people like your character. I think a great example of this is Frodo in The Lord of the Rings. At first, he is picked by circumstance, right? Someone else asks him. And he says, I wish the ring had never come to me. But then later he gets to Rivendell and he sees what's going on. And then he's proactive and he says, I will take the ring to Mordor. And that moment he becomes a hero, right? And every hero in every book needs to do this. When you're writing, make sure that your hero takes initiative. Again, not on everything, but on something, and something that matters for your story.
Huh.
Okay, and then the last one is spirit. So if we've got mind and body, the last one is heart, right? This is their emotions, and they need to be likable. Your readers need to like your characters. There are some exceptions to this, but I mean, this is the beginner's guide, right? You need to make it so that your readers are rooting for your hero. And Joe, in another episode, has taught these points. I'm just going to cover them real fast. The first one is pet the dog. That means your character needs to do something relatable. Like, oh my gosh, dogs are cute. If I saw a dog, I would pet it. And then the other one is save the cat, right? And that means they need to do something good. They need to do something heroic. They need to be making the world better. And these two things, pet the dog and save the cat, are going to make it so that your reader roots for your hero because they have empathy. They feel a resonance with the character.
So I think we covered this in our Save the Cat, or maybe we didn't, and because it happened after. But I was discussing this concept with my writing group, and the idea of Save the Cat, and a guy in it was like, "Huh, I just saw the movie Coco," and he says, "And in the beginning, the little kid kisses his grandmother on the forehead." And immediately I was like, any kid who kisses his grandma is a good kid. It's like, that was pet the cat right there. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a very simple one, you know, but well done, you know.
Yeah.
Man, and I think that's part of what makes it so well done is there wasn't this big thing where he had to go do this heroic thing. It was just here is a kid. And, you know, sometimes kids are weirded out by old people, and he was totally okay with it. And he liked and loved his grandmother. And that was enough to pet the cat.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, that's awesome. Yeah. So, and the point is now we like Coco. We empathize with him. Okay. I lied. I'm going to do one more slide and then we'll wrap it up. So, okay. And I'm going to kind of cruise through most of this. I wanted to point out how Paul Atreides has these items of the braid. Like we know that he's his mom's a Bene Gesserit, his dad's a duke. He has a lot of responsibility laid on him, and he essentially steps up to the plate, right? He's a princely, or maybe I should say kingly, hero. Like he steps up, he takes initiative, and I think we do like him. Maybe weaker on the emotional part, but. One thing I wanted, this is mostly a pet peeve, I guess, that I wanted to hint at here. We talked about how important it is for the reader to feel empathy. And Paul Atreides is like a future king, essentially. You know, I mean, a future duke. He's a prince. And I think most of us, the majority of the world population, don't have that kind of heritage that we're stepping into. And this is kind of I would call this trope the chosen one. And right. We see that with Anakin Skywalker. We see this with Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling knows what it's like to be famous. Like, she can't go to a grocery store because people are going to be pointing at her and saying, oh, you know, there's the boy who lived, basically, right? And right. She taught us what that is like through Harry Potter. But to me, and again, I'm just kind of mentioning this as a pet peeve, because I think it's easy for a beginning writer to say, oh, I'm going to write about the chosen one. But to me, that actually creates distance between the hero and the reader, because I think most readers don't know what it's like to be famous. They don't know what it's like to be pointed at in the grocery store or whatever. Right. And so to me, that's something to consider. Are you making an Anakin Skywalker who everybody's looking at? Or are you making Frodo who's, and honestly, this connects me with Frodo, but if you look at the Fellowship, Frodo's the weakest. Or tied for the weakest with the other hobbits, but he's the weakest of the Fellowship, and to me that makes him that gives me empathy, and that makes me like him, because it's like, oh man, that's just like me. I'm just a regular dude. Like I can't live up to this, and it's cool to see him step in that role as a regular dude and live up to that.
Well, and I think I guess for me, like, the reason Frodo was chosen to carry the ring is because he lacks ambition, right? All the other members of the Fellowship are these great heroes, and they became great heroes because they wanted to be the great at something. And it was that striving that made them these great heroes. But at the same time, that is what makes them unworthy to carry the ring, because yeah. That ambition in them will turn corrupted by the ring.
Yeah, totally. And so you said he lacks ambition. I would like to just frame that as humility, right? He's not trying to make himself into the Steward of Gondor or anything. He just wants to live in his hobbit hole. But
yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so in the show notes, I'll link to the document. I actually don't have a homework slide because I was planning to go on a little more for this episode. But that wraps it up for today, and we'll dive more into characters next time. And we're going to talk about how to build a villain as well, which I think will be really cool. I think that's a really essential character.
Cool.
Okay, if you have nothing else, everyone, thank you for listening. It's time to start writing.